From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are tracking Hurricane Dorian, which largely spared Florida and Georgia as it spun off the coast. But today, the storm is threatening parts of the Carolinas, now as a Category 2 hurricane. Powerful winds and rain are expected in the Carolinas throughout most of the day. And joining us now from Charleston, South Carolina, which is along the coast, is Victoria Hansen, reporter with South Carolina Public Radio. Victoria, where are you now and what are conditions like?
Yeah, hi, good afternoon, Jeremy. I am inside the Gilyard Auditorium. This is a brand new building, a performing arts center in downtown Charleston. It's also where the Charleston City Command Center has set up for the next couple of days. And I am looking out a giant window, and I'm seeing trees bending, swaying, pieces of limbs blowing about. But this is some rain. It's pretty steady, but not quite as heavy as it was earlier. It'll kind of come and go. But I'd say about 4 o'clock, 4:30 this morning, the winds were so strong they rattled the windows and woke me up out of probably a 10-minute nap. But it was much stronger then.
And you tell us the streets are pretty deserted. Does that mean a lot of people listened to evacuation orders?
They listened. They listened not to the evacuation orders, but the orders to stay inside. The order to leave was basically enacted on Monday. A lot of people have become hurricane weary. This is number fourth hurricane where people have been told to evacuate. A lot of people did stay behind, but the mayor of Charleston said, "We want a ghost town. If you're going to stay here, stay inside." Right now, the only people I've seen outside are city police officers.
Earlier today, you spoke with Shannon Scaff, the director of emergency management for the city of Charleston, and asked him what it was like to start to see Dorian's impacts there. Let's listen.
It's pretty surreal. You watch it for days. You watch the video down in the Caribbean. You see what happened there. And then slowly, it's like, you know, it almost feels like a doomsday type event. And then it's on top of you. It's very surreal.
Victoria, what did he tell you about his concerns and the impacts that he's expecting?
All right. The biggest concern today is a high tide and the storm surge of about 7 to 8, maybe 9 feet, more eight to nine, because 7 is when we definitely flood. But nothing like the 10 feet, the record 10 feet that they were initially expecting. I can tell you that during Hurricane Matthew and during Hurricane Irma, they reached levels of 9 feet, and that breached the Battery wall in downtown Charleston. Also, on top of that, this isn't even included yet. We're expecting another 10 inches of rain before this is all done. If you include all the rain we've already had, we're talking about maybe, I don't know, 15 to 20 inches of rain. So this is a big flooding event in a place that doesn't deal with flooding very well.
Doesn't deal with flooding very well, but does have to deal with hurricanes occasionally. There have been some over the last many years.
Occasionally, yeah.
Right. And you've been there for a while. So how would you compare this hurricane so far to past hurricanes in the area around Charleston?
You know, it's like a hurricane is a hurricane. I feel like you live and die 100 times before it even gets here. You know, you watch the cone of uncertainty. I just say the cone of life because it's all uncertain. And you just look and go, okay, I'm alive. I'm dead. I'm alive. You just don't know what to think. And I think that's what's gotten into people, that they don't want to leave. And that's a scary situation, because I talk to folks, you know, who fled during Hugo and say, you know, is this like Charlie Brown trying to kick the football, Lucy pulling it away? And someday that ball's going to get kicked. And you don't want to be here when that happens. So right now, I don't want to say it, because as soon as I say that things are looking pretty good, they won't. So I'm just not going to say. But it doesn't feel as intense as it did earlier this morning. But again, I just got out a little bit today. I'm going to try to head down to the Battery wall to see what the flooding is like. And if it stays in the, let's say, the 8-foot range and we flood at 7, I think that, you know, you hope for the best and you pray for much less. So that would be a best case scenario, I think.
Well, and as you've been watching this storm, as we all have over the last many days, as it, you know, slammed into the Bahamas and then has been sort of skirting the coast of the United States, and nobody really knew exactly what it was going to do.
Sure.
You know, it must have been difficult being there in Charleston, which now is so close to the center of the storm.
Yeah, and I live here, so I board up my home or do the best that I can, and I move on. But what I'm hearing, at least from the command center here, from city police and from emergency authorities, right now they're hearing the biggest problem are downed trees. People are calling in about trees on homes, trees on cars, trees in the middle of the road. Nearly 100 roads in and around the city are closed. That includes the crosstown, which does go across the town and connects us to everybody else.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're hunkering down too, waiting till they can get outside, besides helping people, but assess the damage and recover, we hope, tomorrow.
Victoria Hansen with South Carolina Public Radio joining us from Charleston. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
In Kabul, Afghanistan today, at least 10 civilians and one American service member were killed in a car bombing by the Taliban. As we mentioned yesterday, there was another Taliban bombing a couple days ago. As the Taliban is negotiating a deal with the U.S. to withdraw U.S. troops and set up future talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. But the Afghan government and several former U.S. ambassadors to Afghanistan have all expressed concern that the peace deal in principle, announced by the U.S. envoy, didn't require the Taliban to stop its violence. Others with concern, women's rights activists. Fawzia Kufis is the former deputy speaker of the Afghan parliament. She's in Kabul. And Fawzia, the bombing today must be underscoring your fears.
People are worried and fearful, but in the meantime, I think this has become part of life, unfortunately. Because as I was coming for this interview preparing, just 2 hours after the bombing, people were going in bunches and groups to see a soccer match, a football match in a stadium. And I was like, you know, one part of the city, probably 2 kilometers away from bombing, people go to watch the soccer. So it's a mix of life, I would say.
Well, but there's, you know, first of all, there are many people who feel that the Taliban shouldn't be rewarded if it continues the bombing. The Taliban, members of the Taliban have said that they need to continue to show strength so they can negotiate from a position of strength. But putting aside, and it's difficult to do, putting aside the fact that there are still bombings, you and others have another concern. You don't want to go back to the time when the Taliban controlled the country. This is before the U.S. took the Taliban from power after 9/11. Would explain the difference between Afghanistan under the Taliban and how you've been living now as a woman.
Well, Afghanistan now has transformed. Afghanistan today is able to give space and accommodate women, people of different origin, religious minorities, different political views. In Afghanistan today, girls and women can go to school. And in addition to the buildings and schools and constructions that happen, and you can see it's visible, I think the major things that happen comparing to Taliban regime is the transformation of a new Afghanistan. And Taliban needs to realize and appreciate and adapt to the new Afghanistan. The war has no winner. It's everyday people of Afghanistan that are paying. 2 days ago, I went to my province and I see in 2 hours, three dead bodies of our army soldier were transported to their villages that they lost their lives in the battlefield. So yes, you have on one hand an Afghanistan that don't want to go back. On the other hand, you have a continuously, escalating violence that people of Afghanistan are fed up with.
Well, and we're reminded that the Taliban was able to take power in Afghanistan because of the vacuum created by the war with the Soviet Union. And here you have the U.S. talking about pulling out from another war, concerned that the Taliban will take power again in a vacuum again. But can you see living alongside the Taliban if they're not in power?
If they don't rule the way they want, I think they can be part of the society and even participate in politics. There are many other groups who believe like Taliban and they participate. But if Afghanistan is surrendered to Taliban, if we lose everything just because for the sake of a peace deal with Taliban, I'm not sure if that will also result in peace. I mean, we have to really be careful in terms of absolutely, completely withdrawing from Afghanistan, because you rightly mentioned the vacuum that resulted in coming of Taliban to power. We don't want to experience that. There is Daesh. There are other intelligence and security and terrorist organizations in the region. So we have to really be careful about how we want to make a peace deal with Taliban. Yeah. We want to have a peace with Taliban, but how?
We'll see how that unfolds. Meantime, just briefly, you're the 19th of 23 children. You were put outside to die by your father because of your gender, but your mother rescued you. And then you went on to become the only woman in your family to get an education. There's a lot for women like you at stake here.
True. We have come very far. There are many stories like my story that have not been able to make it a success. But I have made it a success, although I have faced a lot of political turmoil. And I see that as a positive step, because I see if women are getting stronger politically, they face more opposition and their political opponents try to sideline them. So at least there is a space for me to politically exercise my political views. Definitely, I'm a success story. There are women who have not been heard, thousands, hundreds of them. We don't want Afghanistan under any regime, including Taliban, to experience that kind of situation, experience a situation where women resilience, where women progress, where women equality is not respected and regarded. This is something that not only me, I think any woman in Afghanistan, regardless of where they live in the villages, in the cities, are fearful of.
Fawzia Koofi, former Deputy Speaker of the Afghan Parliament. Fawzia, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And we will continue to keep an eye on Afghanistan.
Ten Democratic candidates for president took part in a series of town hall forums on CNN last night, taking questions on their plans to tackle the climate crisis. All of the candidates agreed that climate change is an issue that has to be dealt with, and all want the U.S. to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement that President Trump backed the U.S. out of. Climate change is one issue that is top of mind for Democratic voters, but another appears to be electability. Which candidate is the most electable? Former Vice President Joe Biden has pitched himself as the best to beat the president. Here he is in Iowa in August.
The person viewed as who is best capable of defeating this president rises above the test of I have to agree with the person 100%.
Biden's opponents have pushed back against the idea that voters should focus so much attention on electability.
There has been a lot of conversation by pundits about the electability and who can speak to the Midwest.
The next leader of our party can't be someone that is a safe bet. Oh, let's just find the person that can triangulate and get this done so we can beat Donald Trump.
And so the riskiest thing we could do is try too hard to play it safe.
Are we going to show up for people that we didn't actually believe in, but because we were too afraid to do anything else? That's not who we are.
So what makes someone electable? And is it even possible to tell? Kyle Condick is a political analyst with the website Sabato's Crystal Ball out of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
So you write that assessing electability is like nailing Jell-O to a wall. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think particularly for voters, when they're considering electability, it's not just them trying to determine who they like, but also who their friends and neighbors might like. And in a large field of Democratic candidates, as we have now, I think it's hard enough for individual voters to figure out who they like, let alone trying to figure out who their friends and neighbors might like. And also, from the broad scope of electoral history, you could find lots of examples of candidates who were kind of pilloried as being, quote, unelectable, who ended up becoming president. Obviously, Donald Trump is a great example of that. But you could also look at a Republican like Ronald Reagan or a Democrat like Bill Clinton. And there were lots of questions about whether they actually, quote, could win or not, and they got nominated and won anyway.
Well, and actually, to your point, let's listen here. This is Steve Hayes of the Weekly Standard speaking in January 2016 on Fox News about President Trump.
Well, I think Trump is the least electable, but I'm willing to be, look, I didn't think Donald Trump was going to be a competitor for the Republican nomination. He's clearly a competitor for the Republican nomination. So maybe what I thought I understood before, I'm not understanding. Maybe he would be more electable than I would think.
He was. And then the next person I want to hear about, this is Bill Clinton. You mentioned Bill Clinton. There were questions about his electability. And at a debate in March of 1992, Bill Bonds, an anchor at a TV station in Detroit, had this question for California Governor Jerry Brown, who was running as well.
Does the question, Governor Brown, of Mr. Clinton's recent problems lead you to believe that he has an electability problem?
Yeah, I think he's got a big electability problem.
Well, what do you think it is?
I want to tell you what it is.
Okay, so obviously both of those people, Trump and Clinton, ended up being very electable and becoming president. You also think of Barack Obama, an African-American, a lot of people thought that's not going to be possible. And then he won in a landslide.
Yeah, that's right. And again, I also go back to Reagan in that there were a lot of people, including Gerald Ford, at that time, the most recent Republican president, who basically argued that Reagan was too conservative to get elected, that he was the next version of Barry Goldwater, the Republican who lost in a landslide to Lyndon Johnson in 1964. And Reagan ended up winning pretty comfortably in 1980 and arguably resetting the course of American politics and putting it in a more conservative direction.
Do you think, though, that President Trump's election changed it completely and made it so that really you could say that anyone is electable because he hadn't even held any office before becoming president?
Yeah, I think that Trump's election sort of expanded the bounds of what analysts should consider in terms of who's electable and who is not. And also, I think that American politics has changed to the point where more people maybe are electable than one might have thought before. You know, the classic examples of, quote, unelectable candidates were Barry Goldwater in 1964 lost in a landslide to Lyndon Johnson. And then 8 years later, George McGovern lost in a landslide to Richard Nixon. But keep in mind that election structure was different back then in that voters were much likelier to be able to split their tickets. Voters migrated between the parties much more back then than they do now. And so I think that any nominee of either major party in an era where we have very closely divided elections is inherently electable because fundamentally, I think the Republican or Democratic nominee starts with something of a high floor. And with someone like Donald Trump, who ended up winning the election without winning the popular vote, 46% of the vote was enough for him to win that election when Mitt Romney and John McCain got fairly similar shares of the vote and ended up losing it to Barack Obama. Because the country is so polarized, because voters are so unwilling to vote for the other party, I think that sort of makes the nominee of either party inherently more electable than maybe they were 30, 40 years ago when the electorate was more flexible and we had more blowout elections.
So I think back to 2004 and Howard Dean and that scream moment when a lot of people who maybe had questions about his electability to begin with, after that, they said, well, he's now definitely not electable because of the way that he reacted to the loss in one of the primaries.
Yeah. And I just think back to all of the, quote, gaffes that become a part of the lore of these presidential elections. And, you know, Trump, I think, breaks the mold there, too, in that he has said and done so many outrageous things. And yet, in some ways, he hasn't paid a price for them. Although I would argue that if he were a more conventional president, I think his popularity would be a little bit better. And he would be, I think, in better position to win re-election in 2020. But also, I think that in some ways, Trump sort of changed the definition, I think, of what a presidential candidate was. And I think some people like that, particularly in the Republican Party.
Do you think that electability this time around is a higher priority for voters than it typically is?
I think for Democratic primary voters, I think it certainly is. You see this in opinion polls. People seem to, and also sort of anecdotally asking people what they value in a candidate. I think electability rates up there. And you've heard countless examples of voters saying that, oh, well, they like Elizabeth Warren, but they're worried that as to whether she can win or not. A lot of people see Joe Biden as being the, quote, most electable candidate, but ultimately don't really know. I mean, we're basing a lot of this off of hypothetical horse race election polls that match Biden against Trump and then Warren against Trump. And usually Biden does better than the other Democratic candidates. But there have been some recent surveys that have shown all the candidates doing pretty well against Trump. And Biden may just be doing better because he has better name identification or he's more of a proven commodity. But also these polls aren't really predictive so far out in advance. Certainly there were a lot of polls suggesting that Donald Trump was the weakest candidate against Hillary Clinton at this time in the 2016 cycle. And while it may be that any Republican would have won the presidency against Clinton in 2016, we don't know that. And Donald Trump had unique appeal in certain electorally important places, particularly in the Midwest, that maybe some of these other Republicans couldn't have matched. And so maybe it is that Biden is the most electable candidate, but it could also be that if the Democrats rolled the dice and nominated Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, maybe they would bring something special to the table that Biden didn't have.
Okay. Now, the other thing about Joe Biden is, of course, he is a straight white man. When people say that they're looking for somebody who's electable, how much are they just talking about that? They're saying I don't want a woman. I don't want a minority. I don't want a gay man.
I think there is some of that. And again, this is something that you hear anecdotally from voters, that because Clinton didn't beat Trump in 2016, there is this assumption that the Democrats need to nominate a straight white male to be the presidential nominee. And I guess I personally don't really see that. I mean, Clinton did win the popular vote despite, you know, again, being kind of a flawed candidate running in kind of a challenging electoral environment, in that she was effectively running for Barack Obama's third term. Obama's approval was okay. The economy was okay, but it wasn't necessarily a situation where you wanted to be kind of the incumbent party presidential candidate as opposed to the challenger. I think Trump did benefit from just being the sort of the change agent. So to your point, I think some of this is that the Democratic electorate just wants to be kind of small C conservative in who they choose. But maybe that's really not the right approach. I mean, say what you want about Trump, but it may have been that Trump was the right person to win. Obviously, he did. And maybe he was the only one who could have won.
Do you think voters are missing out on more substantive conversations about issues when they focus so much on electability?
Well, I do think there's some truth to that, although I think also just, you know, voters care about the horse race too, and they're interested in the horse race. And even though I kind of wish that specific policies were kind of more of the discussion, I think voters also inherently care about who's up and who's down and ultimately who can win. They may not necessarily make the right judgments about that. And certainly I don't think that the analysts always make the right judgments about who is electable and who is not. But the mere practice of trying to figure out who can win an election and who can't has to be as old as democracy itself.
That's Kyle Kondek, who's a political analyst with the website Sabato's Crystal Ball out of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. Kyle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And do you take electability into account when voting in a primary? And if so, who do you think is the most electable of the Democrats running against President Trump? Let us know at hereandnow.org. It's going to be a busy weekend for sports fans. The U.S. Open tennis tournament is winding down. The college football season is underway. The NFL season kicks off tonight, and the baseball playoffs are less than a month away. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
I feel like I'm under a lot of pressure. Hello.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah,
let's talk about the U.S. Open first. Serena Williams and Rafael Nadal are through to the semifinals. Roger Federer is out. What are you seeing there?
Serena Williams is poised, although she has a tough opponent to win her 101st match at the U.S. Open. That would break Chris Evert's record. She also, if she wins this whole shebang, would tie Margaret Court as the most singles wins ever for a female tennis player, 24. She hasn't won since she had her baby. She'll be 38 next month. You know, she did come in eighth. She's been fantastic. She's been dominant. She looks like the Serena of old. But then again, she hasn't won a major. She hasn't won a Grand Slam event since motherhood.
And what about on the men's side?
On the men's side, Nadal is the class of the field, and he's also cruising. Djokovic is out, and as you said, Federer is out. But Nadal, I would, again, put the money on him. He does seem poised to rock and roll in Flushing.
Okay, let's talk about the NFL. The Chicago Bears and the Green Bay Packers open the season tonight. We spoke to you when Indianapolis Colts quarterback Andrew Luck surprised everyone with his retirement, but also this is another season when Colin Kaepernick doesn't have a job in the NFL.
Right. So Kaepernick's 31. He is posting on social media, essentially reminding teams, I'm here, I'm working out. He did have a settlement with the NFL that doesn't preclude him from playing. In fact, his co-litigant in that case, Eric Reed, got picked up by the Carolina Panthers. So he did get some money for the 2 years he was out. He's been out of the league now for 3 years. When he left, there was no plausible explanation other than some form of blackballing that he was not given a job. Now, sadly, the explanations become something like, well, you haven't played in this many years, and it's not that unusual. unusual for a quarterback over 30 who's been away from the game for 3 years. So it becomes this unjustified exclusion that is gradually becoming self-justifying. And every time an opening comes up, you hear rumors, but it does seem that it's not just the quality of the player and the slot or the opportunity that is still preventing Kaepernick from getting signed.
What are you expecting in terms of the TV ratings this NFL season?
Well, last year they were up, and I do think that sometimes we talk about these minute differences in ratings, and they're read to a fare-thee-well. All ratings of all TV shows were down in this era of the internet and streaming and just a million other things to do with your phone. And yet last year, the NFL had a really fun, interesting season, and there was a rebound in ratings and a lot of interest. And so I think that I know this, that at the end of the year, when you rank the top 10 most TV programs, the majority, and in past couple of years, it's been 7 or 8 of them, NFL games, not just the Super Bowl, but playoff games, even regular season Monday Night Football games. The NFL is still a cultural behemoth in a time of a fracturing monoculture.
Despite all of those tweets from President Trump, although he hasn't been tweeting about the NFL.
Well, he's
lately.
A cultural behemoth, too.
Right. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thank you.
You're welcome.
While Hurricane Dorian continues to drench the East Coast near the Carolinas, foreign aid is starting to come to the battered Bahamas. USAID teams from Los Angeles and Fairfax, Virginia, have been joined by a British naval vessel. But whole neighborhoods have been wiped out. And we're hearing today from CNN's Patrick Oppmann on the island of Grand Bahama that the airport is trashed. He hasn't seen any ships. He is, and more important, he said, residents are running out of food and water. Major Clarence Ingram is with the International Salvation Army. He joins us by Skype from Nassau in the Bahamas, where he's based and where a relief operation to other islands is being staged. Major Ingram, Patrick was loath to compare Grand Bahama to Abaco, which is also in crisis, but he was worried that Grand Bahama may be overlooked.
Well, we are focusing right now on Grand Bahama. We have just been speaking on a conference call, making arrangements to get 100, 150,000 pounds of supplies in ASAP. We have food and other essentials amassed at our warehouse in Florida, and we're just in the process now of arranging for air transportation so that we can bring it into Grand Bahama and Freeport. We understand that the airport in Freeport, while the terminal is a disaster, shall we say, that the runway has been cleared. So we are working now to arrange a flight to get things in there as soon as we can.
Oh, well, that's so good to hear. And by the way, it's a reminder to people where your change thrown into the Salvation Army bucket goes, in part. And, you know, also the other things that you're going to have to deal with when your people go there. This water is filled with sewage, salt water. We were, you know, hearing these are, yes, you know, these are sea level islands, and the surge practically covered most of them. So I'm assuming the drinking water has in many places been tainted with salt water. And then medical care, you know, tell us some more, yes, of the things you're thinking about.
We know that the drinking water has been compromised and we got to get water in there. We're also going to looking at the possibility of getting a large shipment of water purification kits in there. I think other organizations are focusing more on the medical. We're focusing more on the sort of humanitarian relief of people's immediate basic needs, such as babies that need special food. And we got to get lots of clothes in there because people have lost everything. Those whose houses were not destroyed, we have to get a lot of cleanup kits. We know from experience that there has been in the past a large issue with mosquitoes and things a few days after this. So we have to get some pallets of mosquito repellent and all those other things in there as well.
Yeah.
So it's food, but it's also all those other things just to help people survive.
Look, Major Clarice Ingram, with the Salvation Army based in Nassau, we're going to let you go to do the far more important work and answer that call and get back to what you were doing. And again, a reminder, you are with the Salvation Army. Thank you so much, Major Clarence. Best to you.
All the best. Bye.
Well, we want to catch up now on a story that's been overshadowed by all the recent news. It's the story of Diana Sanchez, a Colorado woman who recently filed a lawsuit against the city of Denver after she delivered her baby alone in her cot in a jail cell at the Denver County Jail. No help, despite her pleas, and a security camera that showed the entire event last year. Her attorney, Mari Newman, joins us now. Mari, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll post this video at herenow.org, but because of it, we can see her pacing in her cell. We can see her going to a door telling people, apparently through some opening, that her water is broken. They slide some kind of a padding underneath for her. They seem to have known what was going on.
That's true, Robin. In fact, they knew that she was pregnant from the time that she came into the jail 2 weeks earlier. And even the day before she gave birth, she was seen by a nurse who noted that she was already in early labor stages. So the fact that they didn't come in and provide her with help when she told them she had been having regular contractions, that her water had broken, that she was passing blood, is really mind-boggling.
And we should say she was in jail because of charges of identity theft. Isn't there a moment when someone is being sent to jail? She was convicted. Isn't there a moment where someone says, how do we handle your imminent, you know, giving birth to a child?
Yes. And in fact, all of the medical records showed that even when she was in the jail, they were well aware that she was about 8.5 months pregnant, that she was experiencing a high risk pregnancy. And for that reason, they put her in a medical observation cell. So the point of that is that jail staff and the medical staff at the jail were supposed to be observing her 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to make sure that if she did need some kind of medical help, she was immediately taken where she could get that. Obviously, that's not what happened here.
Well, and does she say when she was actually then not just having her, you know, her water break, but going into labor and realizing she was about to give birth, crying out, was she talking to people at that time as well through that door?
Yes, records show that 8 or 9 times throughout the almost 6 hours of the morning of July 31st, she contacted guards and medical staff to tell them that she was in labor, the water had broken, she was experiencing contractions, she was bleeding, and she absolutely let them know that she was going to give birth and needed to go to the hospital. Well, but they ignored her.
The Denver Sheriff's Department has released a statement saying that they contract, as you said, with Denver Health Medical to provide medical care at both of the Denver jails. But then they just kind of skip over a bit and say, to make sure nothing like this happens again, we've changed policies to ensure that pregnant inmates in any stage of labor are now transported immediately to the hospital. What they don't say is why these people who are supposed to be, you know, observing her, nurses, why they didn't respond to her, because they've also said that they did nothing wrong. There seems to be a gap here. They say they're going to change the policy. Did they not have a policy to make sure someone would help her as she gave birth?
It's really inconceivable that Denver didn't have some policy that required them to take a woman who is giving birth to the hospital. Unfortunately, I've had to sue the city and county of Denver and Denver Health multiple times before for their failures to provide medical care to inmates that are in their custody. And in one example, over a decade ago, we represented the family of a young woman who died in the Denver jail. And as part of the settlement of that case, we extracted legally binding promises that they would change their training and their policies to ensure that if there was ever a medical need that was so obvious, even to a layperson, that it was required that all of the deputies were trained, not just to take it up the chain of command, but if eventually there was no medical care provided, to call 911 themselves. And yet, Denver didn't do any of those things, which shows either that it failed to abide by the promises that it made over a decade ago, or that it decided to go back on those promises, even though they would obviously save lives. It's really unforgivable.
Well, look, we can't speak to the sheriff's department because of the lawsuit, but it's maybe there were issues of concern of safety for the nurses. But we're talking about, you know, your client was not in jail for a violent crime, and she's delivering a baby.
Well, let's be clear. There's no legitimate concern that there was some kind of nurse safety issue. Ms. Sanchez was a nonviolent offender. She was in jail for having cashed a check that was written to her sister, for which she had received 2 years of probation, but then didn't satisfy a condition of the probation. So she's hardly some sort of dangerous person who would have presented any risk. There's no excuse for it.
What do you think justice for her looks like? What are you suing for?
Well, more than anything else, Diana wants to make sure that this never, ever happens to any other woman or her child. And so one thing that justice looks like is making sure that Denver and Denver Health not just take responsibility for their actions, but truly change their conduct so that they never treat anybody in this barbaric way that they treated Diana and her baby.
How is she doing, and how is the baby doing?
Diana is still really struggling. This has been a horribly traumatic experience for her. She continues to have flashbacks, and emotionally, this has been very, very traumatic. The baby hopefully is going to be fine. So remarkably, her son is okay. But I want to be clear, just because this time Denver and Denver Health didn't kill anybody doesn't mean they're somehow off the hook. The treatment was unconstitutional, and it was really immoral, unethical, and barbaric.
That's Mari Newman. She is the attorney for Diana Sanchez, the Colorado woman who gave birth alone in a jail cell despite her pleas for help. She's now filed a lawsuit against the city of Denver and Denver Health Medical. Mari, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
On January 1st, Illinois will join 10 other states that have already legalized recreational marijuana. But there is still no breathalyzer for weed to tell if someone is driving under the influence. Which brings us to the University of Pittsburgh, where researchers have invented a device that can tell if you've ingested THC, that's the main psychoactive ingredient in cannabis, from your breath. Joining us now is Dr. Alexander Starr from the chemistry department. Dr. Starr, welcome.
Good to be here.
And Dr. Irvin Sadich is also with us from the School of Engineering there at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So people are going to hear breathalyzer and think of the alcohol breathalyzer. Is this similar?
Yes. The device exactly works the same way as alcohol breathalyzer. There's a tube which a recent user of marijuana can breathe into, and the device will measure the levels of THC.
And how does that work exactly?
The technology is based on carbon nanotubes, which are 100,000 times smaller than human hair. That's very sensitive sensor transducers. And when the molecules of THC bind to the surface of nanotubes, it changes the electrical conductance. That's what we're recording.
And what does the device look like?
It looks like any other breathalyzer. It's a box with a mouthpiece into which a person can breathe in.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Sadich, do you think it's ready for cops to use at this point?
Well, definitely, if we have a suitable industrial partner who is ready to just finalize the development, the device by itself would be quite ready in a few months. At this point in time, this is a prototype that we developed at the university, and it works from a scientific point of view. So the next stage would be really just finding an industrial partner who is willing to take this prototype and mass market it.
So one of the issues with trying to detect the use of marijuana has been that, unlike alcohol, police haven't been able to tell whether you just used it 5 minutes ago or whether you used it 5 days ago. But you're saying that this would do that.
Well, there is a recent research that shows that the levels of THC increases after the recent use, and then it decreases. And, of course, it stays in the system for a very long time. So if we can quantify the amounts of THC through research, we can calibrate the sensor and be able to tell if it was recent use or somebody was just smoking pot during the weekend.
Is there any worry about a false positive, falsely flagging someone who didn't recently use marijuana?
Well, of course, like any breathalyzer, you always have a chance of false positives. Even with the alcohol breathalyzers, for example, if you have a few glasses of orange juice, any alcohol breathalyzer will detect some levels of alcohol in your breath due to oranges. So it's similar here. It's possible that there will be some false positives, but the beauty of this technology that Dr. Starr developed in his lab is that it's strictly geared towards marijuana breath, and it's specific to that substance.
How did you get this idea in the first place? I know you started your research back in 2016.
Yeah, that's about the time when marijuana started to be legal in many states, and we saw that there is a need for such a breathalyzer because people, I don't know how this can be enforceable if they say you're not supposed to drive impaired, but how they can tell if you're impaired or not, if they cannot detect presence of THC in your breath.
So do you intend to have this in some sort of a testing phase soon in one of the states where marijuana is legal? Or do you have any authorities anywhere who would like to try it out?
That's the next plan. Now we build the working prototype. The prototype now needs to be tested, and the levels that we're detecting in the breath needs to be correlated to the levels of impairment so such connection can be established.
Why do you think that we've gotten so far along in this country with so many different states legalizing the recreational use of marijuana and saying to people, you can't drive under the influence of marijuana, and yet so far there isn't a product like yours on the market?
Well, it's a bit of a kind of both ethical and legal issue, because given that the marijuana is still a Schedule 1 substance, it's difficult to actually carry out any research related to this substance because it does require extensive paperwork and extensive oversight over any experiments that are carried out, right? So in some other countries such as Canada, this is becoming a bit easier given that they completely legalize the substance for public use. So I think now with more states adopting THC and marijuana as the legal substance, I think there will be some push even for the federal government to actually allow researchers to look and correlate these levels of impairment of smoking and impairment, which is basically missing from the scientific point of view. And you have to remember that even to establish these alcohol levels that we currently use in different states, it took almost 20 years to come up with those levels.
Hmm. Was it difficult for you to do your research on this, given what you just talked about?
Yeah, so when I said that we started in 2016, it took 6 months before that to get all the approval from DEA so we can actually purchase THC and use it in the lab.
That is Alexander Starr and Irvin Sadich, who are two professors at the University of Pittsburgh who have developed a marijuana breathalyzer. We will see what happens with that. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.